Hello, I'm Matt Mayton, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by contributing editor James Mottram.
Hello.
And this week, we'll be reviewing stunt-based action comedy The Fall Guy, and we'll be hearing from the stars of that film, Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. And we'll also be reviewing Rose Glass's follow-up to St. Maud, Love Lies Bleeding, Anne Hathaway's The Idea of You, and the re-release of The Phantom Menace. But first, James, have you been watching anything else this week, or have you been to any film events or anything like that?
Like everyone else in the universe, I've watched Baby Reindeer this week. So, I normally don't watch these kind of hot-button shows immediately, mainly because I'm just lagging behind or watching something else. But this one, I just felt I needed to watch something, and I'd been... I think I actually saw it on Gogglebox, first of all. Obviously, I always watch Gogglebox, which is naturally full of spoilers. But that intrigued me. I didn't know much about it. And then someone I knew had watched it and said it was really digestible. Hmm. And have you seen it yet?
I haven't. No. I'm one of the very few that haven't seen it yet.
Yes. But it's pretty compelling. And the episodes are sort of different lengths, but some of them are reasonably short. So... you do really power your way through it, and it is fascinating. And now, of course, there's lots of stuff in the media about the real life people behind it. People are speculating on who this stalker was that follows the main character. Great performances all round, I have to say. I think it is episode 4. People will, if they've watched it, people will know what episode 4 means when I say that. It's a absolutely crazy, heartbreaking episode as well. But I definitely would recommend it when you get a moment. I think you'll enjoy it. I think you'll power through it.
Yeah, I've heard of episode 4 mentioned too as well, and I haven't actually seen it yet. I haven't seen it yet, but I did go to like a sort of Netflix preview event a little while back, and they kind of showed some of that there. And I thought it looked intriguing, but then it's just always interesting that you can just never really guess the things that are just going to absolutely explode like this and become the thing that literally everyone I know is kind of talking about this from kind of out of nowhere, minimal kind of advanced promo. And now it's just everyone talking about it.
Yeah, it's not a big star-driven show or anything. It's not a Rebel Moon Part 2 or anything like that. It's just something that's captured... the public imagination. And I think not just in the UK, it is obviously a British set story, but I think it's done pretty well across the Netflix sort of span of countries. It's amazing what will suddenly explode and catch fire. But for the guy who, well, Richard Gadd, who stars in it, who's based on his own experiences and his own Edinburgh sort of one-man show that he did, I mean, what a moment for him to sort of suddenly explode like this across the world. I mean, he's probably having a good week, I imagine. And what about you? Have you seen anything or been anywhere?
So I haven't seen that much recently, but I did go on an exciting trip to Pixar in Emeryville in California to sort of visit the animation studios ahead of the release of Inside Out 2, which is coming out this summer. So look out for more kind of content on that. But I've been to Pixar once before. It's always ridiculously exciting. Like, I'm a massive Pixar fan. So I just to even kind of be there in those grounds, it's like a really exciting campus. So I love just getting to visit. It's a huge kind of like privilege of the job. From what I kind of saw and learned about Inside Out 2, it does look very good. Obviously, I'm a massive fan of the first one. An exceptionally high bar to kind of meet or clear. But from what I glimpsed, they've kind of expanded the world, but they looks like they've done it very well. So I'm just very excited to actually see more of the film.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's obviously the first one bowed in Cannes.
Yeah.
Obviously, this time it's not, but the sequel isn't, but which is a shame because it was kind of like a perfect tonic in Cannes, very obviously a very intelligent piece of work. So it fitted right in, but at the same time, such a lot of fun as well. So it was a kind of real pick-me-up in the middle of the hardcore movies you normally get in Cannes.
And the interesting thing being as well, we were both in Cannes that year. So I mean, I know you're there every year. That's the only time I've ever been. But that year you had Inside Out and you had Mad Max Fury Road. And then this summer we got Furiosa, which is obviously on the cover of the current issue of Total Film. But then Inside Out 2 as well. So it's like suddenly kind of 9 years later, we've just got sequels to both those Cannes films. So I think it's going to give me kind of flashbacks to Cannes 2015 this summer in a good and bad way.
Yeah.
But cool. So on to new releases now. And first up, it's a celebration of the world of stunt performers.
Okay, I'm not the hero of this story. I'm just a stunt guy. Trying to look cool in front of the director of this movie. That's her, who I just so happen to have a major crush on.
We need to keep it super profesh.
Cool. Do you want to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
Making out?
Yeah.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
There's just one little wrinkle.
The star of the movie,
Tom Rider,
is missing. We need you to find him.
Why me?
You're a stuntman. No one's going to notice whether you're here or not. No offense.
I mean, some taken.
Tom?
Full disclosure, he has fallen in with some shady people.
Just checking in on you.
And they're not going to like you sniffing around.
I'm just a stunt guy!
So this is The Fall Guy. It is, loosely speaking, an adaptation of the 80s TV show of the same name, which starred Lee Majors. And in the movie version, we have Ryan Gosling in the role of Colt Seavers, who is a top-level movie stuntman who's taken out of action by an injury on the job. But he's pulled back in when a big movie star who he frequently doubles for goes missing. And then Colt turns bounty hunters to try to help find him. And he has a vested interest in finding him and wanting to save this movie because it is the directorial debut of his ex, Jodie Marino, who's played by Emily Blunt. And before James and I review this film, we're going to hear from stars Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. Online entertainment writer Molly Edwards spoke to the two of them last week, and here they are talking about stunts and the Barbenheimer phenomenon.
This is an epic story of cosmic proportion.
Stunts!
The bad guys are closing in.
We're going to hide you.
Nope. We're going to beat this shit out of them. I never forget a fist. I don't mean it like that.
Nothing like a good twist.
Who doesn't love a twist?
This film really is like a celebration of stunt performers as unsung heroes. And obviously you've both been involved in films that involve a lot of stunt work before, but I was wondering, like, was there anything you kind of learned on The Fall Guy that maybe you didn't know before? Has it given you like a new perspective on anything about stunt work?
I think we've always been so full of admiration for stunt performers. You're so grateful for them. Their contribution to cinema is so vast, and I think because of their innate sort of humility and the fact that they're always hiding their faces and disappearing into the shadows, it's sort of been more acceptable to not broadcast this contribution to cinema. And so I think being a part of this film that shines such a light on them, I think I really loved hearing about David Leitch talking about how these stunts are designed, just like production is designed, just like costume design, makeup design. It is an art form. They're crafted and built and dreamt up by these guys for weeks on end. And what you see is an incredible sequence in James Bond or Mission Impossible or Fall Guy, but they've been designed. And I think that was important. That's a very integral word to, I think, what I now view it all as, you know.
They're actors as well. We're all in the same union. And they show up and they also play your character. I mean, you're not the only person that plays your role. They do too, and in a lot of cases they do the more harrowing things, the more dangerous things, the things that really sort of set your character apart from everyone else. You know, it's thanks to them and their special skills and their bravery, and yet they sort of disappear into the shadows and they kind of go uncredited. So it's just such a great opportunity to sort of, and if I can't believe this, it's only happening now, but it's time to sort of acknowledge that and give them an Oscar and acknowledge, give them their flowers and credit. And it's just, it's a fascinating line of work, and they're such selfless and brave people and just made for a really exciting film, and also just doing press for it is fun, because it's fun to talk about it and have them around. And mm-hmm. It's been great.
And something I really loved in the movie was the romance story between your characters. I thought it was so sweet. And I read that you both did like a lot of improv on set. So I was wondering, like, could you tell me more about building that dynamic between Colt and Jodie?
I mean, I think we just want to be really relatable, you know, and that they're a bit of a mess. You know, they don't have these sort of idealized movie lines of like what romantic scenes normally would entail. And it just felt more true to life. And I want to make sure that, you know, Jodie was a really approachable character as well. And then I think discovering that Ryan loves to work in a very similar way to me, and we could wing stuff and we can kind of stretch it around, or it could kind of go off the rails and it was all safe. And I trusted him so much that, you know, if you throw the kitchen sink at it, you could see what happens. And it was just then, I think, made for a couple that you could hopefully root for, and a couple that didn't really have it all together, you know?
We wanted it to feel like what it feels like to really make a film. So just started taking things from what were happening on set. If we were in rehearsals and Emily wore a giant hat that was blowing away because of the helicopter behind us, it was like, oh, that should be in the scene.
Yeah.
She made finger guns at me and then regretted it, but it was amazing. We're like, well, that should be the scene. So anything that was kind of happening on the way to the set became what we
incorporated
into the scene.
And it's, you know, David Leitch is so, you kind of need a director who's curious and interested and in a full embrace of that, you know. So
and
I think
brave, it, because and brave. He's working without a net, you know, but he's a stunt guy, so he's
used to
that.
And we have to talk about Barbenheimer, right? About how, like, the summer of Barbenheimer really brought back the movies or, like, revitalized cinema. And is that, like, something you agree with? And do you think The Fall Guy can be part of that as well? Do you know it's another big summer movie?
I think, well, both Barbenheimer, oh, my God, I almost said it. Barbie and Oppenheimer. Oppenarby. I think what those films did...
No, I think it's Barbenheimer.
I think what both those films did was just to offer people an escape into a new world that seemed really unique, and that was sort of indicative of what we all both then realized audiences were looking for, was that escapism and that confrontation, or escapism or romanticism or humor or something as sort of challenging as Oppenheimer. Like, people wanted that and ran to that, and so it was one of the most moving summers for me in a big way, not only just so proud to be a part of a film that was doing that, but then kind of persuades you to put your feet to the fire more, and that this is the way to go with making films, is just to keep striving for something unique, you know. And everyone on Fall Guy, that's what we tried to do every day, was just try to make something to make people as happy as possible and as entertained as possible. And I think that world that we created of things that were off the cuff, chaotic, spontaneous, is maybe what people will like about Fall Guy, I hope.
So that was Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt on The Fall Guy. So just to set this up a little further, this is directed by David Leitch, who previously made things like Atomic Blonde, Deadpool 2, Hobbs and Shaw, Bullet Train. And he famously was a stunt performer and then stunt coordinator. He doubled for people like Brad Pitt in his heyday. So he obviously knows this world inside out, and his films have always had kind of big stunts in them. So this is very much a kind of celebration of stunts, but also it's very much a kind of meta film, because we're following the making of this film. So Jodie, who's played by Emily Blunt, is this director, and she's making her first film, which is called Metal Storm. And it's this massive kind of sci-fi Western romance thing that's being shot in Australia. And then Gosling is Colt Seavers, who's this stunt performer. They kind of had a fling in the past, but then when he sort of went away due to his injury, things kind of didn't go well between them. And so there's kind of a bit of tension when he arrives back on her set kind of unexpectedly to her. But then he's obviously got to seek out this famous action star, Tom Ryder, who's played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson. Colt has doubled him a lot over the years, but he's gone missing now, and they kind of need to find him to finish the film. So Colt's going to use his skills as a sort of stunt performer to try and find what's happened to Tom. That's kind of how the plot and everything kicks off. It's one of those films that's sort of a bit of everything. It's kind of a rom-com, kind of a noir, kind of an action film. Again, a film about filmmaking as well in many ways. So that's how we kind of start. But did you enjoy this film, James?
Absolutely. It was heaps of fun, I thought. It's funny you say it's a bit of everything, and that's completely correct, because obviously it's got stunts, and as you said, David Leitch has got this back history with stunts, so there is plenty of action. And as you say, there's a sort of noirish detective element which taps into the original Fall Guy TV series. There's obviously, there was always a sort of mystery at the heart of episodes in that. But really, for me, it is all about Gosling and Blunt and their chemistry. So for me, it is a kind of romantic story, a romantic comedy at its heart. That's the thing I really sort of tapped into. I thought we kind of saw it when they, Gosling and Blunt, presented at the Oscars, and they were kind of riffing on the whole Barbenheimer phenomenon. And Gosling was talking about how there should be a best Oscar for stunts, which there definitely should be. And you kind of caught a little bit of their chemistry right there and then on stage, in the middle of the Academy Awards. And that really comes across on screen. They're sort of effortless-less, sorry, that's hard to pronounce, yeah. Effortless. you know, in their kind of ease with each other. They're proper movie stars, and there aren't so many of those around anymore. And yeah, they work completely brilliantly at the heart of this. I mean, it's in the trailer, but there's a whole sequence. I think it actually comes quite near the end of the film, but where they're kind of riffing about getting spicy margaritas together. And, you know, while in the middle of Gosling performing this incredibly insane stunt, and there's just something so delightful about their chemistry together that, yeah, I just had heaps of fun with it. Aaron Taylor Johnson is an absolute scream as a kind of A-list a-hole, we could call him, I guess. he works brilliantly there. And then I think the one you didn't mention, but is equally fantastic, is Hannah Waddingham from Ted Lasso, who is this producer, sort of Hollywood producer, kind of like, I think I described her in the review I did for Total Film, of like Joel Silver in Heels, basically, because she's kind of this, you know, uber producer. And she's hilarious as well. I mean, she really sends up the industry. Just that character alone sends up the industry brilliantly. Yeah, there's just so much to enjoy in this film. It's just so much fun. I mean, what was your take?
Yeah, I'm very much on the same page as you. It's like the main word I would use is crowd pleaser, because it's just got that, like, it just feels like a fun sort of Friday or Saturday night film. Like, you feel that you could kind of almost go and see it with anyone, really. There's sort of something to enjoy. And like you, I think it does really get so much from the chemistry from Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt, because Gosling's kind of, he's sort of at his most like charismatic here, really. Kind of, there's few really, I think, kind of actors of his generation working today that can kind of match him, really, when he's got that full bore charisma going. Emily Blunt's just kind of great as well. And so many films that come out, they try and sort of do the romancing the stone type chemistry, and they sort of, you know, look to that, but just doesn't quite come off. But this is one where I really think it really did, and it really kind of, they really spark together, and you kind of hope that they'll either do more of these, or that they'll just, you know, be returned to work with each other again, because I would definitely think, you know, I would definitely look out for any kind of future team ups they do, just because they clearly did sort of spark so well off each other.
Yeah, I mean, given that, you know, it is by a director who's well known in the stunt universe, I think what's good about the film is that it doesn't rely on the stunts. The stunts are in service of the story. They're perfectly thrilling. There's a sort of speedboat chase through sort of Sydney Harbour, because a lot of the film is set in Australia. And I thought that was a great stunt. But the stunts aren't essential to the story. It's very character driven, first of all. I mean, the stunts are, you know, they're nice decoration, shall we say. But first and foremost, for me, it was a kind of character-driven, you know, romantic comedy. You know, David Leitch, as you mentioned, he did Deadpool 2, so he's used to dealing with humour, but that's very much built around the Ryan Reynolds persona, you could say. Whereas here, it's more of an ensemble comedy, really. And, you know, he really steps up to the plate in terms of directing actors, directing comedy, which perhaps he hasn't done quite so much of in his career previously.
Yeah, I would say this is the best film he's made so far. And yeah, and it's just kind of really, again, really crowd pleasing with like the music. Like Kisses, I Was Made for Loving You plays a big part, and that's kind of like worked into the sort of score as well, as kind of a theme throughout. And you also, there's a great use of a Taylor Swift song in there. You might have glimpsed that in the trailers already. And I'm a sort of sucker for anything that kind of tongue in cheek or not kind of shows you behind the scenes of making a film, and the kind of things they're dealing with. There's just, yeah, there's a lot of kind of fun to be had there. Just the kind of, yeah, all the stuff that they're showing going on behind the scenes, and all the ways in which like Emily Blunt's character is just pulled in so many different directions when she's trying to make this debut. And yeah, there's a lot of fun bits of that. And there's actually, it's kind of no spoiler to say this, but you will kind of need to sit through the at least the first half of the credits, because you get a lot of behind the scenes footage basically of them pulling the stunts together. So after watching this film, it is then great to just see that kind of glimpse behind the scenes. And so I really enjoyed that part of it as well. So just overall, yeah, a really enjoyable kind of, you know, romp. And like you said, it's interesting how much the romance element is kind of foregrounded. That was a sort of a pleasant surprise here.
Yeah, and it worked. And obviously, you'll be waiting for a Metal Storm spin-off now as well. I mean, I wouldn't put it past Hollywood to do that. So an executive looking at it going, that's quite a good idea for a film. Let's do Metal Storm. But Yeah, I don't know. Would you want to see another, like a Fall Guy 2, though? I'd like to see them back together, yeah. Like you said, but I don't know. Sometimes I think, don't spoil what you've done. You know, I mean, obviously the Fall Guy itself, the TV show, there were 5 seasons of it. Mm. Plenty of narratives you could hook from there, I guess. But this is the one thing I find strange. I mean, I have a couple of criticisms of the film. Mm. One is I think the last act does go on a little bit too long.
Yes, yeah, I'd agree there as well.
I think it runs to just over 2 hours and I don't think it needed to. I think it would have been fine at, say, an hour 45. And the other thing is, and this is not so much about the film itself, I think what they've done with the film is really clever. But I'm curious, like, you know, for you, for example, did you really know what The Fall Guy was as a TV show? And it's not that big a show. In the 80s, it was popular, I remember it. But we're now getting to that point where every IP is being mined. And you just think, this film could have been made without the title The Fall Guy and without Gosling playing Colt Seavers, who was the Lee Majors character in the original. And you just think, you could have made this about a stuntman. It had nothing to do with The Fall Guy. And really, is anyone going to go and see this film because they remember the TV show from the 80s? I don't think so. But anyway, that's me nitpicking, but there you go.
It's interesting because I did the feature for this. And so I interviewed kind of David Leitch and Gosling and Blunt. It was clear that like David Leitch was obviously a big fan of the show. And it was one of the things that kind of inspired him to get into stunts. So I imagine it kind of means a lot to him. But yes, it was something which the show had completely passed me by, and I obviously kind of, you know, learned about it in kind of researching in readiness for this film. But yeah, it was never something I really watched. And I guess that the name sounds vaguely sort of familiar, but I suppose it's just used a lot in sort of different ways anyway, isn't it? Because it has that kind of double meaning. And there's kind of references like the truck, you know, if you know, but yeah, I know what you mean. You wonder how much they actually needed it and how much it would, that name will bring people in, but maybe it's a bigger deal in the US. But
yeah, that's possibly true. Mm. It might be being repeated in the US perhaps more than it has been here. Yeah, that is possibly true. I hadn't really considered that, but I more think about it as like symbolic of what's going to happen in Hollywood next in the next 10 years. What else are they going to mine, basically? Mm. Well, The Fall Guy is not obscure, but we're now heading in that direction. Mm. I mean, if we've got, you know, films about plastic dolls and, you know, 1980s TV stunt shows. I mean, where are we going to go next?
Well, I sort of said a similar thing about Challengers last week, but this is one of those films that I do actually hope it does well, just because even though, as we, you know, it is obviously based on something, but it's not kind of well-known IP in the way that a lot of these franchise films are. I would love to see this film just do well on the strength of like the star chemistry and it being a bit of an original. Obviously, I mean, I know we just kind of said it's not, but it's not like riffing on stuff in a nostalgic way in the way a lot of these kind of things do. So in that sense, I hope it does do well, but it'll be very interesting to see how it does do when it opens. If you fancy seeing that is The Fall Guy, which is in cinemas from Thursday the 2nd of May. And next, it's time to get pumped up for this one.
The excitement in the air is palpable. The atmosphere is electric. A celebration of history in the making.
What is this place? You're looking pretty good in there. There's some pretty serious lines going. Yeah? Why don't you want me working for your dad? Well, he's a psycho.
I saw that big girl.
That you two are maybe together.
Do you like guns?
I prefer to know my own strength.
That's not what I'm paying you for.
If you touch her, I'm gonna tell them everything you ever did.
Are you threatening me?
This is Love Lies Bleeding. James, could you set this one up for us, please?
Absolutely. So this is set in kind of small, dusty town in New Mexico in the late 1980s. And Kristen Stewart plays Lou, who is a sort of gym manager. Her father, Lou Sr., played by Ed Harris, he runs a gun range out of town. And Lou falls in with a bodybuilder, Jackie, played by Katie O'Brien, who's kind of busting through town. She's on her way to Las Vegas for a bodybuilding competition. She's got very little money. And one of the first times you see her is kind of having sex in front of a in a sort of pickup truck with character played by Dave Franco, who turns out to have some connection to Kristen Stewart's character. And she's only having sex with him just to try and get herself a job, basically, because Franco's character works at the gun range where Lou Senior is. And anyway, the two girls kind of, they become an item. And then I don't really know how much more I should say about it.
Yeah.
Because it's such a kind of twisty plot. Basically, let's just say Stewart's family are not exactly law-abiding. And as the story goes on, so Lou and Jackie, their fates cross with this criminal family. And it gets bloodier and nastier from there.
I know you like this, James, because when I spoke to you about it recently, you said it was one of your favourite films of the year so far. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. It's one of those that, I don't know if you ever get this, but, and it doesn't happen to me very often, but like the moment the titles came on the screen, which is right at the beginning of the film, which is, you know, it's not one of these sets of titles that come in 20 minutes later. You know, it's obviously the words Love Lies Bleeding in this kind of red colour and this kind of font kind of reminded me of Lost Highway slightly, the David Lynch film. There's quite a few nods to Lost Highway, I think, in this film, which is a you know, a huge favourite of mine. And anyway, the moment I saw those titles, I just thought to myself, I'm going to like this film. You can just tell by the aesthetic choices that this is going to be the kind of film I personally like. It's hard to say, hard to articulate exactly why. Mm. It's just something that's inside you. And I should add, this is the second movie by Rose Glass, who the British filmmaker who did St. Maud. Now, St. Maud was a film I liked and sort of respected. I wasn't as blown away by it as a lot of people were. I thought it was, you know, pretty solid for a debut. But I feel like this is just such a huge step up. I mean, obviously, she's gone to America. She's working with Kristen Stewart, Ed Harris. I mean, that is a step up in itself. But just sort of narratively, I felt this film is so solid and so tight and so exciting and so weird as well. I mean, I don't want to go into any of the weirdness of the film because that kind of comes in the second half, but my God, it gets strange. And for me, really, really worked in its strangeness. Yeah, it's just a kind of killer noir. The heart of it is also it's a queer story, which, I mean, recently we had Drive Away Dolls, the Ethan Coen film, which I didn't particularly get on with. But you could say with that film, you know, they built a caper story around two lesbian characters. It, likewise here, that it's a crime story built around two gay characters. But, you know, the fact that their sexuality isn't really important in both those films, it's just part of baked into who they are. And, you know, I think that's really interesting as a sort of progression. You know, it's no longer we're having to sort of have, you know, gay films about people coming out. That's something that happened in the 90s, perhaps possibly. And now it's just fascinating that these kind of stories are coming out around the same time. But what did you make of it?
I really liked it. Not quite to the level that you did, but I really enjoyed it. I loved St. Maud, and I actually slightly prefer St. Maud to this, I think. And it's very impressive that, like, whilst you could draw comparisons between them, they do feel very different. So I think kind of credit to Rose Glass for that she's kind of, you know, had that success and then has just gone on to just take a real sort of left turn in terms of style and everything and really showing range just like two films in. I had a similar experience to you where I'd say almost perhaps for the first like 30 minutes or so, I was like, wow, I'm just going to absolutely love this film. I just love the sort of the grimy aesthetic of the world and the sort of 80s detailing and things like that. I really liked the characters and I really liked, their sort of connection and their romance between sort of Lou and Jackie. Katie O'Brien, who is kind of, you know, like sort of something of a bodybuilder in real life. And she's been in a few things like, she has been in like The Mandalorian and she was in Ant-Man and the Wasp. You know, there's a few things you might have seen her in, but this was the first time I'd seen her sort of, you know, in this big of a role, really. And I really, really warmed to her. And Kristen Stewart always does kind of interesting work. And I thought she was very good here as well. And a very interesting supporting cast as well, particularly the kind of, you know, the sort of the sleazy likes of Dave Franco and Ed Harris.
Ed Harris with a ponytail as well. I mean, you just can't argue with that.
But then it was one of those things that I kind of enjoyed it all the way through, but I didn't love the rest of it as much as I'd love that kind of first half an hour. And maybe there was part of me that obviously, again, in the direction the story goes, I maybe just wished that we'd had Lou and Jackie together a bit more on screen than we kind of get in the sort of later part of the film. But all that said, I still really enjoyed it. I kind of enjoyed the weirdness of it. Still, you know, like it's like one of those things. It's like those are sort of fairly mild criticisms for me. It still falls firmly into like, you know, a sort of a recommend, and I would give it a sort of a good 4 stars if I was reviewing it, you know.
I mean, talking of films that, you know, we were saying with The Fall Guy and Challengers, you hope these films do well because you want to see more of these kind of films. I would say the same for Love Lies Bleeding. Obviously, it's an independent movie, but even films like this don't get made so much anymore. And yet, you know, in the 90s, you had these kind of things all the time, you know, The Love Seduction or Red Rock West, films like that. And I just feel, again, it's a rarity now. Also, one that's been so made, you know, that's so accomplished in the way it's been made. But, on top of Dave Franco, who I think is brilliant in the film, you've also got Jenna Malone, who plays his wife, who's Lou's sister. She is almost unrecognizable in the film, but brilliant that she pops up as well. Yeah, it's got such a cool cast. You mentioned the grimy aesthetic. It's definitely grimy, but there's something quite sexy about it as well, if you know what I mean. It's just, you just don't see many of these anymore. And I think that was part of what, like I said, in terms of the, you know, getting excited just at the titles, opening titles, it's like, yeah, I just don't see this kind of stuff very much. And it's like, I want to see more of these kind of the movies I grew up on, I suppose. So I want to see more of them.
Yeah, and you mentioned kind of sexy there as well. And that is something I would say, like, it is quite an erotic film. And there is sort of some genuine heat between Lou and Jackie, even though it's not like particularly graphic or anything. But yeah, I did think it was one of those films like with genuine chemistry, again, sort of following on from Challengers. So that was kind of an aspect of the film that I thought was really well done as well.
Yeah, I've got to say, I didn't find Challengers particularly erotic, apart from the scene that's obviously trailered, where the three of them are there kind of kissing. But yeah, I think after that, I didn't find the film erotic in the slightest. But, you know, it had some good chemistry in it, I guess. But this would be more to my taste, I think, Love Lies Bleeding.
So, if you like the idea of that, that is Love Lies Bleeding, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 3rd of May. And now it's time for a very different type of romantic drama.
How did you guys meet? We need to know the story.
We met at Coachella. Hi.
Hi.
This is your trailer?
Yeah, I'm in the band. We're performing on the main stage.
August Moon?
Yeah. I met someone tonight. I feel a little inspired. This one's called Closer.
Selene, we need you up front, okay? Like, now.
I don't know if you remember me, but we met in Coachella.
Yes, I remember you.
Well, I desperately need some artwork.
Why don't we start in the back?
I like these.
Ah, fantastic.
This piece is from my friend Sarah.
What's it called?
Unclose Me.
And what do you feel when you look at it?
Everything.
So that was The Idea of You, which is like a new sort of romantic drama coming to Prime Video. It's like a streaming original, this one. And it's based on a book you might know. But the story is really, it's kind of a fairly straightforward premise, which is that there's this woman, Solène, played by Anne Hathaway, and she's a 40-year-old single mum, and she basically ends up taking her daughter to Coachella, the sort of the music festival in the US, because her husband's supposed to be taking a daughter and friends as a treat, but of course, like, a business thing comes up for him, so he can't make it. So he says, oh, please take her. So she does, and then through a couple of like contrivances, she runs into this young singer of the boy band that they're there to see, and he's a kind of like a Harry Styles type, I guess you could say. From there, basically, a romance starts. So the film kind of, you know, follows what happens from there, really, as this 40-year-old woman begins this relationship with this young, world-famous boy band star. Yeah, so it's based on a book by an author, Robin Lee. And I've heard things say kind of, you know, like, there's sort of a type of fan fiction that, you know, that in some ways it was inspired by kind of Harry Styles and things like that. But I've read an interview with the author where she denies it is based on him.
Yeah, I think the author was refusing to say which boy band she was inspired by, and we'll probably never find that out. Well, probably one day we will.
But I suppose in some ways there's sort of a wish fulfillment element to it. Yes, and so, and obviously, as mentioned, you've got Anne Hathaway in sort of the lead role as Solène, And then as the young sort of boy band star, Hayes Campbell, you've got Nicholas Galitzine, who has recently kind of, he's one of those kind of rising stars where he's most recently been seen in the TV series Mary and George. And he was also in Red, White and Royal Blue, which was sort of a kind of streaming film hit from last year. Yeah, so that's the basic premise. And again, without getting into too much detail, obviously, kind of goes on from there. I've seen some places this as romantic comedy, but I would say it falls more into the romantic drama bracket. I wouldn't say it was too much of a comedy. And it's directed by Michael Showalter, who sort of most famously did The Big Sick, but he's done kind of quite a few TV series of note. He's also made other films like he made The Lovebirds with Kumail Nanjiani as well. And he also did The Eyes of Tammy Faye with Jessica Chastain. So he's one of those, you know, very, very competent director, clearly. And for me, I just thought this film was just, it was just kind of solid. It was fine. I kind of enjoyed watching it enough. I'm always kind of intrigued by like the world of fame and seeing behind those kind of closed doors. And I like Anne Hathaway. But to me, it was just fine, but never really, truly, you know, set my world alight. But how did you find it, James?
Oh, dear. Yeah. Well, first of all, you mentioned Michael Showalter, and I very much enjoyed The Big Sick. And I feel like this is a sort of a step down on some level from that. It's like you said, it's fine. It's hard to get too excited about it. I really like Nicholas Galitzine. I'd seen a bit of Mary and George, so he's very effective in that. And like you said, rising star. And I really think he's good in this. I think he captures that, let's say, essence of a boy band member really well without it ever falling into cliche. I mean, there's an interesting exchange they have where he talks about, he doesn't name it, but a sort of a lead singer, I think it is, of his favorite band who once sort of got in contact with him. And he was thinking, oh, maybe we'll go and do a duet together or cut an album together or something. And it turns out that this lead singer of this band, his child was a big fan of August Moon, which is the name of the boy band that Galitzine's character's a part of. And he was sort of saying to Hathaway's character, my biggest fear is I'm going to be a joke. And I think that's probably something that, you know, boy band members do worry about. You know, it's like once the screaming stops, to sort of quote from that Bros documentary, what happens next? So, you know, I thought he had an interesting arc, and I thought that worked well. I was kind of less interested in the romantic drama itself, the kind of will they, won't they between him and Hathaway's character, Selene, this sort of art gallery owner who has a daughter who once upon a time was a big fan of August Moon, sort of less so now. And yeah, I didn't find the romance that interesting. You mentioned bits about fame. There's quite a nice bit when they leave her gallery. He's just come in and swept in and bought all these artworks. He has to sort of, he knows exactly how to sort of navigate fame. So he's telling her to, they're driving off in her car and he lowers his seat so he can't be seen, you know. And you imagine that kind of stuff does go on all the time. So he's kind of lying flat in the car while they're driving past all the photographers who are outside snapping pictures of him. So there were little nice little moments like that, but I'm not the biggest Anne Hathaway fan, if I'm entirely honest. And I feel like, you know, this is just a bit run of the mill. And I didn't think she brought anything great to it. Yeah. So that's how I felt about it, really.
I actually thought they had quite reasonable chemistry. And I thought he was pretty decent as well. I thought, you know, in a kind of rising star type way, I thought, oh, yeah, you know, I can see him having kind of future potential. But then I suppose I didn't feel massively compelled as it went along. There's obviously kind of, you know, an element of like wish fulfillment to it. And I kind of imagine that was there in the book, but I haven't actually read it, so I can't really comment. It kind of feels like a very superficial film in a lot of ways to me. One of the things which was a sort of a letdown for this type of film was that I didn't really buy the boy band as like they perform a couple of songs in the film, but they feel like exceptionally generic. Like obviously it's kind of, it's always great when you just see a film and the boy band songs just pop.
I've never been to Coachella, so I can't fully say I'm intimate with everything they program there. But surely that festival would not be programming a boy band. That just doesn't seem right somehow.
I couldn't comment on that. But the music didn't really sort of pop for me. And then in the concert scenes, they didn't really have that energy of like, wow, this is like, you know, what you expect from this band. They're clearly supposed to be like a One Direction level of fame. Just almost just didn't feel like that kind of the intensity that you expect from those kind of, you know, screaming concerts. that was a slight disappointment as well. And I still think from recent years, I think the high watermark for on-screen boy bands is Four Town from Pixar's Turning Red. And they had a couple of songs in that film that Billie Eilish and Phineas kind of worked on the songs in that film. And when I watched that film for the first time, I just had those couple of songs just really stuck in my head. And I just didn't have that at all with this film. And I mentioned Superficial, and I sort of thought it just didn't really dig into these issues kind of particularly deeply. Like, there's obviously kind of something to be said about kind of age gap relationships, especially when it's the woman who's older with the younger guy. And that's kind of touched upon here a bit. There's a touch of that sort of empowerment hinted at, especially in contrast to her sort of previous relationship with her ex. But it doesn't really dig particularly deeply or dramatically into that. And then there's some stuff about fame that you mentioned, you know, and them kind of, you know, him sneaking out with a car seat folded back, and, you know, this is just the idea of photographers following him everywhere. But I felt like it could have kind of digged much deeper into what that life is like for someone, and then what that life is like when it clashes with a quote unquote normal life.
Well, I think you summed it up earlier where you just said superficial. And I think that's kind of what this film is, running all the way through it. Mm. I thought, by the way, when you were mentioning the Turning Red boy band, I thought you were going to talk about pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping. Don't know if you've ever seen that, yes. But the Andy Samberg film, which I think is absolutely a masterpiece. So, yeah, that's another great sort of look inside the pop universe, you know, proper comedy. But yeah, this never really got there. It's perhaps too, I don't know, reverent of these boy band characters to make it. It's not really a satire. That's the thing. They're just background noise, basically, which I guess is what they are.
Yeah, to me, it was an easy enough watch, but not exactly like essential viewing. But if you fancy that, that is The Idea of You, which is an original going to Prime Video on Thursday, the 2nd of May. And now it's time for our final film of this week, which is a 25th anniversary re-release.
I've encountered a vertex in the Force.
The droid army is about to attack the Naboo.
If something else binds. And there's something about this boy.
At last we will reveal ourselves to the Jedi. At last we will have revenge. Accelerate our plans. Begin landing your troops. Wipe them out. All of them.
So this is Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. James, for anyone who's been living in a galaxy far, far away for the past 25 years, could you set this up for us briefly, please?
Sure. So this is obviously the origins primarily of Anakin Skywalker, who will later become Darth Vader. Here, of course, a little boy played by Jake Lloyd. We find him on Tatooine. There are other elements as well. Obi-Wan Kenobi, played by Ewan McGregor, and his Jedi mentor, Qui-Gon Jinn, played by Liam Neeson. They ultimately encounter Anakin. There's also, you have Padme, played by Natalie Portman. On the Empire side, or the evil side, we should say, then you've got Emperor Palpatine, played by Ian McDermott. I can never pronounce his name. Ian McDermott, I think it's pronounced. And the mighty Darth Maul, played by Ray Park, who does his bidding, shall we say. These characters all come clashing together in, you know, well, what is George Lucas's first part of his original space opera?
And it's interesting, obviously, because as much as you can say this, general audiences' relationships have changed with these prequel films over the years, as of mine somewhat. And I don't know what it was like for you, James, but strangely, and this may surprise certain people, but I wasn't kind of the biggest Star Wars fan before I'd seen Phantom Menace, because I was about, I think, oh yeah, so 99. So I was sort of 15 when The Phantom Menace came out. And I'd seen the other films, but I wasn't kind of massively into them by that point.
Well, yeah, you were the wrong generation. Yeah. Kind of like, you were born after the Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
So you missed the hype around those original three movies, I guess.
I started getting into the Star Wars films much more in my kind of like late teens, sort of 18, 19 kind of era, I suppose. And so in some ways, when I first saw it, I didn't have quite the disappointment that a lot of people felt with this. So it was obviously kind of so anticipated, wasn't it? And you just didn't have quite the same level of, like, you know, legacy sequels and prequels and things back in those days as we sort of are oversaturated with now. I mean, it like we say, it's could say it's about any film, but it's just wild for me to think this was 25 years ago now. Kind of terrifying. But my feelings have changed quite a lot over the years. But like overall, I just don't think it is great. But it's one of those films that I just don't think it's great, but I think it has some great elements to it. And particularly it just has these sort of handful of like standout action scenes. And particularly I still think that the sort of three-way lightsaber duel between Darth Maul, Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan Kenobi at the end, I still think that's the best lightsaber duel in the Star Wars universe. Just the kind of speed of it and just how cool Darth Maul was with his double bladed lightsaber.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a brilliant, and it's also, you should say, one of John Williams's best scores, which is used in that sequence, the Duel of the Fates, which I'm not going to hum it now, but but I often do. Yeah. I remember when it came out and we were getting into it, I was humming that tune a lot. That really got under my skin. I remember it was quite early on in my career and being, you know, I grew up on the Star Wars films and being massively hyped for The Phantom Menace. I mean, it was a killer year, 1999.
Yes,
you also
yeah.
had Stanley Kubrick coming back with Eyes Wide Shut. You had Terrence Malick coming back with The Thin Red Line. You also had The Matrix that year, which, of course, came out of nowhere. You know, many, many other great films as well came out that year. And so by comparison, The Phantom Menace was a disappointment to a lot of these other films. And the hype was enormous because it was Star Wars. Yeah, look, you know, there are issues with it. Jar Jar Binks, we haven't mentioned. We managed to get through The Phantom Menace without mentioning Jar Jar Binks. And obviously he's this kind of CG animated character, quite groundbreaking in that sense. But everyone kind of loathed him. You mentioned how people are perhaps more affectionate to the films now. I think little kids like Jar Jar Binks, you know, who weren't reared on the original Star Wars films. So, you know, Lucas was probably right to put that character in some respects. Yeah, I think the lightsaber duel, as you say, is incredible. Likewise, the pod race, I think, was also really, really well done. And this is sort of when Anakin's showing his kind of early skills, you know, in the desert, in this kind of huge race that they're all going through. So there are moments to really enjoy. But then everyone always used to focus on, you know, the opening crawl of the text that, you know, famously comes down in every Star Wars film. And it's banging on about Trade Federation deals. It's not exactly sexy. It's not exactly a sexy way to start this sort of 9 film operatic saga. So, you know, it's got problems. It's not the greatest way to ever start, you know, a sort of film series that's as renowned as Star Wars. But I don't know. I have problems with prequels anyway, because we all know that ultimately the idea is that Anakin Skywalker will grow up and turn into Darth Vader. We already know that. That is not a spoiler. You know, so it's always quite hard to get excited about something that's joining the dots a little bit because, you know, the killer moments are already revealed effectively. And yeah, I think lots of prequels, not just the Star Wars ones, suffer from that lack of excitement in some level. We know what's going to happen. But you know what? If it's on the cinema, which is coming back into cinemas, I might give it another go, actually, just to sort of see how I reflect on it now, 25 years later.
Yeah, just like I say, for me, it's just for the set pieces, really, it's kind of worthwhile, because you got the pod race, obviously, which I remember finding like ludicrously exciting when I saw it in the cinemas. And then, like, obviously we've already discussed the lightsaber duel, but that whole kind of end scene where there's the kind of battle going on and Anakin's flying around as well. That's one thing that George Lucas is very good at, is kind of cross-cutting between different kind of, you know, action moments and kind of, you know, you managing to sort of follow them all and it doing it in a kind of like a neat, clean way. That is something he's kind of underrated at doing. It leaves you on a high, at least. And the thing I was most disappointed about was I was, like so many people, were just so excited about Darth Maul. And then he's in it so minimally, really. But now, like, kind of when you go in knowing that you kind of, you know, you only get him, and then obviously it's limited time. But yeah, what a great kind of moment he does have.
He does indeed. You know, it's definitely flawed, but I think it might be worth a revisit.
Definitely better than Attack of the Clones as well, we could say so. it's got
yeah,
that.
Yeah, although I do enjoy the Yoda lightsaber fight where Yoda's spinning around like a crazy banshee. I was always fond of that moment.
Yeah, I loved Attack of the Clones at the time, but I feel like that is the one that's just aged the worst out of the prequels for me.
Yeah, in terms of the third one, I felt that for all the flaws of all the prequels, that moment at the end where they're looking at the Death Star being built, and it's just an absolutely brilliant shot sort of from behind them, and it's like of Darth Vader and the Emperor. And I just thought, it's almost worth it just for that shot. but not quite, almost.
Okay. So that is, of course, Star Wars Episode One, The Phantom Menace, which is back in cinemas from Friday, the 3rd of May. So, James, what is your film of the week this week?
It's easily Love Lies Bleeding.
Yeah, so for me, I mean, it's almost too close to call between Love Lies Bleeding and Fall Guy. But in terms of just pure sort of crowd-pleasing enjoyment, Fall Guy probably just edges it for me, but there's not much in it. And Love Lies Bleeding, very interesting film. So just, yeah, hard to call, but I'm going to, as you've gone for Love Lies Bleeding, I'll take the Fall Guy. But we're approaching the end of the podcast now. Don't forget to check out the current issue of Total Film Magazine featuring Furiosa, which is out on shelves now. Perfect reading for the bank holiday weekend, I would say. And don't forget, if you take out a subscription, you can get instant digital access to that issue before your first print copy arrives. I'll drop a subscription link in the show notes. And talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, we would love it if you could subscribe on your podcast app of choice. It really does make a difference and it means you'll never miss a new episode. And remember, if you want to, you can always contact us on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for a quick question. And inspired by The Fall Guy, what is your favourite movie stunt, James? Or at least the kind of the first one you remember being really impressed by?
Well, an early one would be in the James Bond film, The Man with the Golden Gun, where the car does this incredible corkscrew spin when it goes off a kind of goes over a river. All done for real, of course, not done with computers. And yeah, absolutely remarkable stunt. So there you go. That's a classic one for me.
Yeah, Bond very much. I mean, I think of a lot of Bond movies, particularly sort of Roger Moore ones that I watched in my youth. But the main thing that always springs to mind for this for me, and it's a really obvious one, but it is the whole truck sequence in Raiders of the Lost Ark, because just something about it, I mean, it's just so well done. It still stands up now. It's just an incredible set piece and just kind of screams like adventure. And like there was just something for me as a kid, and kind of, you know, the escapism of sort of action adventure movies. There's something about just there being vehicles involved and going under vehicles and back on them and hopping between them and everything like that. That just kind of epitomizes, you know, on screen stunt action for me. So that's the one that I kind of always return to as probably my favorite. And it's just one that sticks with me from a really young age. So I'm going for Raiders of the Lost Ark there.
Good choice.
And that's all from us this week. So thank you for listening. And until the next one, goodbye.
Bye. It's true, I hire my body out for pay. Hey, hey, I've gotten burned over Cheryl Teagues, blown up for Raquel Welch. But when I wind up in the hay, it's only hay. Hey, hey, I might jump an open drawbridge or Tarzan from a vine. 'Cause I'm the unknown stuntman that makes Eastwood look so fine.